Today's Taisho will be on case 7 in the Wukongkang, the Wu Men Kwan, Joshu's Washer Bowl. A monk said to Joshu, "I have just entered this monastery. Please teach me." "Have you eaten your rice porridge?" asked Joshu. "Yes, I have," replied the monk. "Then you had better wash your bowl," said Joshu. With this, the monk gained insight. Mumon's comment. When he opens his mouth, Joshu shows his gallbladder. He displays his heart and liver. I wonder if this monk really did hear the truth. I hope he did not mistake the bell for a jar. Mumon's verse. Endeavoring to interpret clearly, you retard your attainment. Don't you know that flame is fire? Your rice has long been cooked. This is, at least for one person here, this is the first sesshin. And perhaps for a couple people, this is the first sesshin of this kind. Basically, when you're coming to sesshin for the first time, you're in for many interesting experiences. Everything you do is going to be a little new. So if you're like I was when I first came to sesshin, getting up at 4:30 is new. The way we eat. We have a strange eating practice. We have three bowls. Rice goes in the big bowl. Soup or vegetable goes in the second bowl, and so on. We eat with chopsticks. You know, we wipe the table down, we clean. You know, we have other kinds of rituals. We walk in a line. Some of this is familiar from the Thursday night sit, but some of it's novel and unusual if you haven't come to sesshin before. Much of Zen practice is like that. You know, interesting to see how people bow. The sutras are rather exotic. If you go to some Zen temples, even in the United States, they're very beautiful. You know, they may have shoji screens, sliding rice paper screens, may have, special oryoki ritual, special eating ritual with lacquerware bowls and so on. And, all I can say is if this is your first sesshin, please, stay alert and do your best. Don't worry if you make mistakes. You know, if you don't clean your bowls properly, you can always take them into the kitchen quietly afterwards and clean them out. You know, if you spill something, that's okay. It's not the end of the world. If you drop your chopsticks, it's not a major faux pas. I dropped my chopsticks. First thing I did was put my chopsticks on the table today, and then I hit them with my arm, and they went flying. So it doesn't. You know, making mistakes is not a big deal. An important thing is to get through the sesshin. And if you're new, I would recommend that you get plenty of rest during the rest periods. And we have some chairs here. We have a couple chairs. You can bring a chair in from the dining room. There's no disgrace in shifting from your cushion to a chair. If this is your first sesshin, many people here have had difficult first sesshins, and nobody will think less of you if you sometimes take a breather by sitting in a chair. At any rate, you should know the chair is always there for you if you do need that breather. So please take it. Don't be too hard on yourself. So, you know, if you're coming to Sesshin for the first time, all of this is sort of novel and special. But what if you're not coming for the first time? What if this is your third time, or your fourth time, or your 20th time? There's a certain sameness to all of this. Maybe you've noticed that. In Japan, there's nothing special about shoji screens. You know, in America, when people have a lot of money and they build Zen centers, they put in Japanese architectural features like shoji screens. And maybe someday in Japan, when they build Zen temples, they'll put in American-style Venetian blinds, because they actually serve the same function, right? I mean, basically, shoji screens are no more exotic in Japan than Venetian blinds are here. It's just we think they're special. Eating out of three bowls, the Orioki service, has been ritualized, but there's nothing special in Asia about eating rice from a bowl. That's just how you eat rice. You know, eating with chopsticks is not a ritual in Asia. It's just the simplest way to eat, right? And we clean our bowls just because with water instead of washing them in the kitchen, because it's the fastest, simplest, and least wasteful way to get through the meals. So there's really nothing, there never has been anything special about any of the things we do at Sesshin. It's all set up to facilitate the kind of experience, and that kind of experience actually requires routinization. It actually requires making everything absolutely dead simple and totally predictable. So after the first sesshin, the experience of predictability, here we go again, is going to be an inevitable feature of your practice. There's not supposed to be anything special going on at Zen practice. And believe it or not, this is a wonderful thing. Wonderful thing. You know, so often we work so hard to adorn our lives, to make them interesting or special. So, you know, I have friends of mine who are like religious listeners to National Public Radio. They get up at, I have a friend of mine who gets up at 6 o'clock and listens to the BBC World Report. And then, basically, she's a colleague of mine, and she's like a news addict. She gets up at 6 and listens to BBC World News. And I know it's on because when I drive up to North Jersey, I sometimes listen to it myself in the car. But she listens to that. Then she gets NPR, now All Things Considered, in the morning. Then at 9 o'clock, it's another BBC broadcast. And then on her way to work, she listens to Brian Lehrer, the Brian Lehrer Show, which is called Talk of the Town, where they talk about issues. So by the time she comes into the office, she has plenty of things to talk about. Usually she's a very nice person, by the way, my colleague, and I love working with her, but she's very political. Remember that I work in a university, so you have to be political if you're... by the time she gets to work, there have been so many news items and so many... It's like she's bursting with the desire to tell me about how the world is going to hell in a handbasket. And, you know, it's interesting, isn't it, to live like that. There's always some new detail coming across the wires. We can get upset, we can be, you know, we can talk about it, we can look at it from this angle, from that angle. And in a certain way, it makes us feel more alive. You know, I have... friends who are like experience junkies also. You know, they literally go all over the world, and even on their weekends, these are not people who have to work on the weekends. They're driving down to Philadelphia to do this and that, and You know, basically they're constantly on the lookout for something new and interesting. You know, trying to make life interesting. And I think that people who live like this some people are trying to feel that they're getting connected to life. You know, it's like, I'm not really connected to the world unless I listen to BBC World Report at 6 o'clock in the morning. And I think my friends who just came back from New Zealand and who are going to Australia next year are trying to store up like a storehouse of memories. At the end of their lives, they're going to say to each other, we really were here, we really lived, we really had something wonderful. You know, we've been to Indonesia, Bali, Australia, Paris, Spain, France, and really they've been every, you know, you'll never catch up if you decide to live this way, you'll never catch up with them. And I really, you know, knowing them as I do and actually really loving them, I've been fascinated by this idea that at the end of their lives they're going to have like all these rich memories. And I think they feel a kind of tension all the time because they're afraid they're not going to store up enough memories before their time is up. This is very common. And of course, you know, in a consumer society also, we're all well aware that people are constantly trying to make their lives special or make themselves special through the things they acquire. So, you know, when I was in college, I didn't have much money, and sometimes my wife, who was in the import business, would be able to get something from China or Japan very inexpensively, and we would hang it up in our home, and it was just like it. We hadn't been to China or Japan, but it made the house seem special. And this is there's nothing wrong with this. You know, it's part of the human experience. But there's another way to live, and Zen is like the other way, another way to live. You know, where instead of trying to make life special, instead of trying to store up memories, instead of trying to create a rich and meaningful life, we actually stop doing that. This really runs counter to so much of what we humans do and what we modern people do. But I think people in other times and places have understood this very well. You know, many of you probably don't remember the governor of California, Jerry Brown. But at one time, there was a governor named Jerry Brown who was a very controversial governor in California because he actually had been, he had done Zazen. He had actually been done meditation. And he was youngest governor of California of all times. And he was this swinging, crusading governor. And He did many interesting and innovative things that nobody had done before. He was really an original person and made things very interesting for the state of California. Eventually, I guess he made things a little too interesting because he got voted out of office. And then he was thinking maybe he would run for president. And his girlfriend was a rock star named Linda Ronstadt. This just shows you how this is all from another generation, but she was really a very popular singer at the time. So they went on a global tour in a private plane, a fact-finding tour that was supposed to be Mr. Brown's beginning of his presidential campaign. And I myself was very interested in this tour because I loved Linda Ronstadt's music. I used to just love it. So they went all over the world, and they landed in Africa at one point, and they were out on the plains of Africa, and Jerry Brown got out of the plane and went out to talk to some Maasai people who were herding their cattle. And he was trying to rub elbows, I guess, with people from another culture. But they were out there herding their cattle, and he sat down with them and tried to talk with them through an interpreter. And then at one point he said, "Well, you know, what do you do for recreation?" And they didn't have a word for recreation, and they had no idea what he meant. They said, "Well, what do you do for recreation?" They didn't get it, you know. They have a different sense of life. You know, they're not trying to make life special. They have different pace, different attitude, different perspective. I think people in other times and places have understood what it means to have this other perspective on life. We're not trying to be special. We're not trying to achieve something here. We have this other way of life. This koan is so simple, right? Monk comes to the temple and meets Master Joshu. And he's maybe come to the temple to have a special kind of experience. Maybe he wants to have an enlightenment experience. Maybe he wants to have Kendai Kensho. Maybe he's looking for, we all have fantasies about what enlightenment is like, you know. For years I had these ideas that, you know, what would enlightenment be like? I just thought it might be like an earthquake or, you know, miracle. I had various fantasies about it. And every time I came to Sesshin, I'd be thinking, well, maybe this is it. Maybe this is the one where I'll have the breakthrough. And I remember I was at a Sesshin once, and I had this dream. I was working on the breath perception koan. I'd been working on it for years, and I had this dream, and in my dream I saw the Buddha coming out of the wall. It was like I was facing a wall, and this golden Buddha was coming out of the wall, and then it started slipping back into the wall again, and then it was gone. And when I woke up, I thought, well, maybe this is it. Maybe this is the sign I'm going to answer my koan. So I went in to see Genki Roshi, and I didn't have the answer, of course. This koan is so simple, right? But it appeals to something that all of us have, which is this desire for a special experience, desire for a kensho, breakthrough, you know, miracle, enlightenment. Monk comes to the temple looking for something special, and he says to Joshua, "I just entered this monastery. Here I am. You know, teach me. Show me the secrets." And this reminds me so much of myself. I mean, when I started training, I really did think that Genki Roshi had secrets that he was going to tell us behind closed doors. I mean, you might think I'm kind of a naive person or kind of a stupid person, but I think that's a common, you know, on some level, we think maybe it's going to be like that. You know, that I actually thought Genki Roshi during Dokusan was going to say, okay, here's what you have to do. You know, there's, when I was a kid, I used to read these comic books, which were called, Doctor Strange, is that right? Doctor Strange. It was about a mystic warrior, and he would enter many different dimensions, and the same man who drew Spider-Man drew Doctor Strange. And I just can't even describe how amazing this comic book was, because he wore amulets around his neck, and he had a lot of Asian. He had a gong in his ritual room, and he had Buddhas all over, and he would disappear into another dimension. You would see half of his body disappearing, and then he'd be in this other dimension that was sort of like with no boundaries. He'd be floating in the air, and there'd be these red discs or something like that. And then he'd have to do battle with these equally mysterious figures. And I guess part of this lingered on in my thinking about Zen. I really thought there were mystical practices that Genki was going to teach us. And instead, all we did was sit on our asses all day, you know, with our legs hurting. So this monk is sort of like I call this Tibetitis. He's got Tibetitis, right? says, here I am, you know, show me the secrets. And Joshua says, have you eaten your rice porridge? Did you have your oatmeal today? And the monk says, yes, you know. Well, then you'd better wash your bowl, said Joshua. Now, you know, many monks would just walk away and say, what a disappointment. You know, he's the great Joshua. I thought he was going to teach me the secrets of enlightenment. And instead, all he did was ask me if I had my oatmeal this morning, and he told me to wash my bowl. What a disappointment. Maybe some monks would even leave and just think, there's obviously no enlightenment here. Right? But this monk is a little different because somehow this begins to register with him. You know, the utter simplicity of what we do is so important. You know, it's not necessary to have any kind of special experience at sesshin. You know, we talk about kensho, and I talk about kensho, and I talk about breakthrough, and so on. But actually, this might be profoundly misleading, or profoundly, this might create obstacles. Because the proper way to enter sesshin is to hear what Joshua is telling us today. Let's not have anything special today. Let's just be in this moment, right? That's so hard for us to do. We have so many expectations and demands. And when people come to sesshin, they have motives of various kinds, conscious and unconscious. You know, sometimes the motive is, I hope I hit the Buddhist jackpot and have kensho. Sometimes we're coming to sesshin because we might feel that we've committed ourselves to this way of life. And, you know, sometimes people come to sesshin because they feel obligated to come to sesshin. And sometimes people come to sesshin because their hearts and their minds are on fire with anxiety or fear or disappointment and pain. All people come to sesshin with some kind of a motive. And, you know, it's very hard for us just to be in the moment because we have these motives, we have these expectations. And so, you know, Zen practice is really about letting go of everything. Motives. You know, whatever you came here to achieve, please forget about it today. You know, whatever you came hoping to discover, hoping to achieve, hoping to break free from, please give up on those aspirations today and just be in the moment. And this is actually quite difficult. You know, last Saturday, I was talking about some research I had been reading. I'm very interested in the brain these days and all this new brain research that's being done on people who meditate. And I was talking about the fact that this man named Ramachandran has done some experiments on how the brain really works. And for those of you who weren't there on Saturday, let me just tell you about the experiment. You know, Mr. Ramachandran hooked up electrodes to a bunch of students' heads. And he wanted to see what the brain does when action takes place. So he put the electrodes on the heads of these volunteers. And what happens is when you, and he asked them to move their fingers. He said, I'm going to put electrodes on your head and I want you to move your fingers. And I want you to tell me when you are deciding to move your fingers. See? The experiment was to see what the brain does in that process. Now, when you decide to do something, like wiggle your fingers, the brain actually makes a spike. If you have a little screen and you look at the brain waves are flat or just sort of like a little mountain chain. then suddenly they spike up sharply, and then they drop back down, and then you move your fingers, see? So the brain is operating a normal way, then it prepares to act, to initiate an action. It spikes up, electrical activity spikes up, and then it drops back down, and then there's an action. And they hook the machine up to make a little beep, so when it spikes, it goes beep. Okay, so they put the electrodes on the students' heads, and what we expect to have happen is this. We expect the student to say, I'm preparing to move my fingers. Then we expect the machine to go beep, and then we see the fingers move, right? So I want to move my fingers, the brain prepares to move the fingers, beep, and then the fingers move. But that's not what happened. Interestingly enough, that's never what happened. Mr. Ramachandran, Dr. Ramachandran, discovered that what happens is the beep comes first. So even before you know you're going to move your fingers, your deep mind, your big mind, already makes the decision. So it's beep, and then the subjects didn't know, they didn't hear the beep. See, that beeping is happening in the other room. So the beep comes first, then the subject says to Dr. Ramachandran through the microphone, I'm preparing to move my fingers, and then there's the moving of the fingers, see? Well, this sounds almost crazy, right? It's before we even choose to do something, the outcome has already been decided by something else. By what? By what I would call big mind. And Zen practice is about surrendering to big mind. You know. And what we're doing here is putting aside that little mind which thinks it's going to achieve something, thinks it's going to accomplish something, or thinks that it's in control of life. You know? And we're just going to turn things over to the pilot, to the master. We can't see the master's face. You know, actually, the big mind isn't accessible to the little mind. The little mind, that's why people don't know that the brain is already sending the signal. They think they've chosen to do it, but it's already been chosen for them by big mind. We create a lot of problems for ourselves because big mind sends us a signal and then we say, well, that's not what I want to do. Should I do this? You know, and so on. And so we begin to complicate our lives enormously. So one way to understand Zen practice is learning how to take orders, learning how to take instructions from big mind. And the way we do that is to give up completely the aspiration to be special, to have any kind of particular experience, to foresee any kind of particular outcome. It's absolutely simple. Just be in the moment. But very difficult because we want something to happen that's not necessarily going to happen. But this is the practice of Zen, you know. You come to the sesshin, say, here I am, I'm ready for a special experience. And Joshu says, wait, the practice of Zen is giving up on special experiences. And we do this by cultivating attention to the moment just as it is. So if your koan is breath perception, just watch, just be with the breath. There's nothing special about this breath or the next breath, or the next breath, or the next breath. And yet, you know, if you begin to be one with your breath, life is going to be very beautiful, very wonderful. Nothing will have changed except your awareness. Right? A shift from little mind to big mind. And it won't be that you have some insight, see? It's not like you can come into the Dokusan room and say, I finally understand. Breath is X, see? That has nothing to do with Zen. It's just suddenly this familiar world is completely different. It feels completely different. You feel completely different, but nothing has changed. from the standpoint of little mind. See, my legs still hurt, I'm still tired, it's still hard to get through 25 minutes, but somehow I feel really wonderful. No, I haven't listened to NPR today, so I have no new ideas. I haven't acquired anything interesting. I haven't accomplished anything. There's no degree program in Zen meditation, fortunately. So nothing is going to be accomplished here. But when we turn things over to big mind, suddenly everything is different. Or when that happens, may not be suddenly, may take a little time. And so attention to the moment is washing our bowls. This is Joshu's washing your bowls. Come back to the breath, back to the breath, back to the breath. If your koan is mu, it's called. Every mu is exactly the same from the standpoint of the small mind. There's nothing interesting going on here. It's the same, every sesshin, it's the same darn mu, you know? But if you can just accept that and be fully in the moment, little mind begins to go to sleep and big mind begins to wake up. Big mind begins to be heard, not as a concept or an idea, but as a sense of deep connection to everything around you. And you can't choose to make that happen. Choosing, liking and not liking, these are all little mind activities. The big mind has its own timetable and will present things to you as it chooses. And this is what makes Zen so wonderful. How wonderful. So, you know, please have no aspirations whatsoever about sesshin. Please have no expectations. This is actually, aspirations and expectations are really poison, really cause us an enormous amount of suffering, especially at sesshin. You know, if you come to sesshin and say, I've been working on this koan for 3 months, I sure better answer it. This is like sabotaging yourself. Or if you come to sesshin and say, I just know I'm going to have no more pain. It's like, not a chance, not a chance. Or if you come thinking anything else can be accomplished, you know, please give that up right here and now. The beauty of this practice is the beauty of life. You know, really and truly, life has no reason. You know, the universe wasn't really created, so to speak, or the universe created itself, actually. The universe didn't create itself for any purpose. It's just a free play of being, or the free play of non-being, if you want to put it that way. You know, there's not a purpose, is a small mind idea. Right? Purpose is small. Universe is just unfolding endlessly in this endless fountain of compassion. Oh, endlessly unfolding in all possible forms and varieties. And this is amazing and wonderful, but not for any reason. What reason could that be? So, you know, big mind is beyond reasons, beyond purposes. Purpose means I have to fix my car because one of the headlights is out. Purpose means I need to get a small loan to fix the windows at my house. The universe doesn't have purpose. That's a human imposition, in my opinion, human imposition. There's no beginning and no end. We tell stories that say, once upon a time, this little boy was born and his name was such and such, and then he went into the forest and this. But we know reality doesn't actually have a beginning and an ending. That's what makes it so amazing. So please give up all aspirations to enlightenment today. Please give up all aspirations to solving your koan. Please give up all aspirations to escaping from your pain, or from all aspirations to be a better person, and just be in the moment. Right? That's the job today. Just be in the moment. Nothing can be accomplished here. Nothing. If you have worries from your life, please realize sitting on the cushion and thinking about your worries is absolutely pointless, because you cannot solve your problems here. Don't even try. Just be in the moment. And strange as it may sound, you know, that is real deliverance. That is real freedom. That's real unification with the universe, which also has no purpose, no intention, and no accomplishments. You know, those are merely human fictions. And actually, those all obstruct the fundamental love at the heart of this universe. So please don't obstruct it. The universe has no reason. It just is. Love has no reason. Compassion has no reason. Just is infinitely, unconditionally present. A monk said to Zhaoshu, "I have just entered this monastery. Please teach me." Zhaoshu said, "Have you eaten your rice? Have you eaten your oatmeal?" "Yes, I have," replied the monk. "Then you had better wash your bowl." Be in the moment. With this, the monk gained insight. Mumon's comment, when Zhaoshu opens his mouth, he shows his gallbladder. In other words, he told it just as it is. The universe has no purpose. The universe has nothing to accomplish, nothing to earn, nothing to gain. Those are fictions. He displays his heart and his liver. I wonder if this monk really did hear the truth. I hope he did not mistake the bell for a jar. And they look the same, but they're not the same. Mumon's verse, endeavoring to interpret clearly, endeavoring to have an accomplishment, you retard your attainment. You create new obstacles. Don't you know that flame is fire? This is it. Buddha nature is right here, this moment. Your rice has long been cooked. Nothing to accomplish. Nothing to gain. It's all right here. Just be in the moment. Okay. And that's the most wonderful thing. You know, people who have really suffered understand this, I think. You know, just to be in the moment is such a gift. You know, there are people who have suffered real, like, mental illness problems. Just being able to have this quiet mind is like the greatest blessing. Some of you know Pradeep Mukherjee, Peter Mukherjee, whose wife Sharmini used to sit with us until she became physically incapacitated. But she may not even be alive now. Pradeep called me up and she collapsed and she's in the hospital and may die. And she's been so sick. And sometimes we sit together before the Monday and Thursday night sits. And, you know, she has such pleasure being in the moment. You know, it's like there's no hope of getting better. You know, she's got a lot of physical pain. And sometimes when we sit together, she's just so happy because it's just being in the moment. Such a great blessing. That's just wonderful. So please, you know, the moment is really wonderful. Don't let your expectations get in the way of it. and that we'll all be in the best part of it. Is that we're all here together, and this all in this moment together. It's really wonderful. So let's be there. Page 20. Shujo Muhan Segando.